from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, are extroverts more persuasive than introverts? And does commission motivate good workplace performance? Daniel Pink examines the science of sales, including a variety of everyday tasks that involve what he calls non-sales selling. The author and former speechwriter for Al Gore will join us to talk about his new book, To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. His previous books include Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, and A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. Daniel Pink, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Daniel Pink is with us this hour. He was supposed to be with us last hour, but the news conference, of course, preempted that. And Sarah Ogilvy, who was scheduled to be with us in this hour, will be rescheduled. Daniel Pink's books have been translated into 33 languages. Like it or not, we're all in sales now, he writes in his newest book about how selling is central to the world's economy and to economic advancement. He's the author of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, and A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. And the recent book, To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others, is out and available now. And we should mention a little bit more about his background. He served as a speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore, also a former aide to former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, and joins us for this opening hour. And good to see you again. Welcome.
It's great to be back on Forum.
I was kidding a little bit before about the title here, To Sell is Human. It makes me think of Alexander Pope being a literary guy, to err is human, to forgive divine. But it's a good way to capture the interest of listeners, Daniel Pink pointed out to me. But let's get to the heart of this book.
Sure.
It's caveat ventor now, not caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware becomes now let the seller beware.
Yeah, well, it's both. I mean, buyer beware is still good information. It's still good advice. But today, the world of sales has changed dramatically. Most of what we know about sales, the reasons we think it's skeezy and sleazy and slimy, is that it came from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer. When the seller has more information than the buyer, when the buyer doesn't have many choices, when the buyer can't talk back, it is buyer beware. But now, it's a different world. Now,
it's not sleazy anymore?
It's less. Oh, well, here's the thing. There are always going to be people who are sleazebags, all right? Let's just recognize the nature. I mean, you're a literary guy, okay? The nature of humanity is that some of us will do skeezy, sleazy things. But in terms of the pragmatic consequences of that, that approach to sales doesn't work anymore. It only works in a world of information asymmetry. Let me give you an example of this. Let's say that you, 20 years ago, go in to buy a Chevy. You go in to buy a Chevy. That Chevy dealer is going to know a lot more about Chevys, about cars, than you ever will. Buyer beware. Seller has a lot more information. You don't have a way to talk back. Today, walk into a Chevy dealer. You can know as much about cars as that dealer. You can know as much about Chevys, if not more, than that dealer. I interviewed a car dealer.
You go to the doctor and know more about your medical condition than the doctor. This is all online phenomenon.
Doctors are also in many ways, the persuasion influence business. And now you have some amount of information parity even in physicians and their patients. But if we go back to that car situation, that car salesman in a world where there's information parity has a different job fundamentally. And the low road is less and less of an option in all realms, whether you're pushing Buicks on a car lot or whether you're peddling ideas in a meeting.
Well, like you said, I am a literary guy. I think of things like Glengarry Glen Ross and Death of a Salesman, and it's all about selling oneself. It's all about the fact that you have to have the jokes and have in fact, Dave Eggers has a new novel all about a salesman. He has jokes that are ready to tell. You have to be likable, all those kinds of things. And the theme of all those is always be closing. And, of course, for Daniel Pink now, it's a different ABC.
That's right. I mean, in Glengarry Glen Ross, the movie, not the play, they added a scene in the movie where Alec Baldwin goes in trying to kickstart these sad sack salesmen at a place called Mitch and Murray. And he goes in there. Of course, he insults their masculinity, and then he gives them some sales training. And he says, A, B, C. A, always. B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. The steamroller approach, not that effective anymore. If you look at the social science today, it gives us a new set of ABCs about how to get better at persuasion, influence, and selling. A, attunement. B, buoyancy. C, clarity. Attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. Social science gives us some really, really interesting clues about how to deploy those ethically and more effectively in the service of moving others and, again, selling your idea to a group of investors, selling your boss on the idea of giving you a new project, selling, as is in my case, my 10-year-old son on taking a shower after baseball practice.
And selling your book, which is what you're doing, too.
I mean, absolutely. Helping you sell this radio show.
Well, I appreciate your help, Dan. There's also an improvisational element to this that's become necessary from your research and that people need to be really aware of and attuned to again.
Absolutely. One of the among the particular skills is the skill of improvisation. A lot of sales is quite interesting. If you go back in time and look at sales training, it was very, very scripted. I mean, they were essentially writing these little mini plays for the sales force, telling them exactly what to say, even giving them stage directions about where to point at certain instances. They were boring plays, but they were written like plays. Now, the scripts don't matter as much. What matters more is the ability to improvise, because your pitch, your perfectly attuned, appropriately buoyant, super clear pitch is going to go awry eventually. And so how do you respond to that? And it turns out that the lessons of improvisational theater give us some ways to do that. Saying yes and, making your partner look good. And what I thought was, at least for me personally, really insightful is what improv artists do is that they hear offers. You say something to me or a prospect says something to me, embedded in there is some kind of offer.
Well, any kind of listening any kind of selling involves listening. It's an integral part of what selling is all about on any level, is selling yourself and so forth. But you also say at one point, be a chameleon. And a lot of people might recoil at that. You know, they think of myself, wait a minute, my authenticity is important. If I'm selling myself or selling my ideas or my product, whatever it is, I want to be genuine. That's an important existential fact. Why be a chameleon?
Well, here's the thing. The important existential fact here is that most people are chameleon-like. We actually adjust our perspective, our way of talking, our physical gestures based on who's there. It's a way of providing affinity. You don't talk to me the same way you might talk to a 7-year-old child or a 90-year-old man. You're actually being a human being by adjusting your temperament, by adjusting the way you approach people to the people whom you're talking
Maybe
to.
Maybe it's just the connotative power of a chameleon.
Absolutely.
Your skin.
No, there's no question about that. But the social science really uses that term. This is why I prefer to use something like attunement, which is, are you understanding where someone is coming from? Are you seeing the world from their perspective? Are you understanding their interests? And that requires some adjustment on one's own part.
Isn't that a lot of emotional intelligence, really? Isn't that what it's about?
Sure. There is a lot of emotional intelligence, but this idea of attunement or perspective taking turns out, according to the research, to be very much a cognitive skill, too. There's one very interesting experiment where they send people into a negotiation setting. Half the people are instructed, think about the other person's interests. The other half are instructed, think about the person's feelings. That is, one, focus on what they're thinking, the other, focus on what they're feeling. And when the results of the negotiations are tabulated, it turned out, perhaps a little to our dismay, that the people instructed to think did better. They did better not only for themselves, but they did better for the other side as well. That is, that attunement is very much a cognitive skill. Can I understand your interests? Can I understand what you are thinking?
Talking, if you've just joined us, with Daniel Pink, who is the author of Drive and A Whole New Mind. His new book is called To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Now, let's get into this whole idea of moving others, because that's key to a lot of your research here. It may be indeed the fact you write about EdMed and education and medicine, two big fields now where selling is almost de rigueur for people, but all fields, really. I think the basic thesis here has a great deal of punch to it, the idea that everybody needs to sell or vend, if you will, whatever their product might be, whatever they represent. And yet, moving others, where does moving others come in?
Well, you know what? Let's look at the facts here, because one of the great things about writing today is that you have a lot of tools available to you that you didn't have before, things to put a little bit more meat on the bones. So, first of all, you can go very easily analyze data. And what the data show very clearly is that 1 out of 9 people in the U.S. workforce are in sales. Their job is to get other people to buy stuff. But I was curious about that other 8 and 9. what do they do for a living? And so I fashioned, using working with a data analytics firm, fashioned a survey of 7,000 adult full-time workers. And one of the questions we asked people was this: what percentage of your time do you spend trying to convince or persuade someone else to give up what they have for what you have? And that what they have could be time, attention, effort, in exchange for what you have. And we found that people were reporting they're spending 40% of their time at work in this thing called, that I call non-sales selling, but is essentially moving other people, convincing, cajoling, trying to get them to go from from this point to that point, to make an exchange of resources so both of us are better off.
That includes your boss or whoever has the salary that they're signing for you, et cetera?
That includes people listening to this program who are choosing to devote this wonderful hour listening to us rather than doing something else.
Talking again with Daniel Pink. There's also a sense of a kind of subaltern role that you imply here. Let me get into that with you. I mean, you increase the power, you talk about, of somebody else when you're selling them on an idea or whatever it is you're selling them on, and you lower your own power or something along those lines. There's a danger in that, isn't there? You could be a sycophant. You could be just a person, a yes person, right?
No, actually, I should disagree with that. Here's what the research shows. Let's go back to attunement and perspective taking. What the research shows very clearly is an inverse relationship between power and perspective taking. The more power somebody has, the more powerful somebody feels, the less likely they are to take another person's perspective. And so one better way to take someone else's perspective is to go into an encounter and think to yourself ahead of time, I'm not the powerful person in this encounter. The person, let's say you're an employer talking to an employee. I'm your boss, all right? And I talk to you and I can say, I'm the boss, so Krasny should listen to what I have to say. Instead, I should say, you know what? Maybe Krasny needs me. Maybe I need Krasny more than Krasny needs me. That lowering of my power, feeling of power, will enhance my ability to take your perspective. It's not sycophancy. It's actually adjusting myself so I can see the world through your eyes.
It's a kind of empathy, you're saying, in other words.
It's a first cousin of empathy. It is can I understand the world through your eyes? If I'm anchored, the problem with power is that people in power anchor in their own position. And so they don't see the world from other people's points of view.
People in power can be blinded by their power, of course. Yeah.
Part of that blindingness is that there is actually it's blinded in the sense that they're wearing blinders. They're seeing only things from their own anchored position, not looking at things from your point of view. So because there's a very clear inverse relationship between power and perspective taking, when we're in these kinds of encounters, we should actually consciously say, hey, wait a second. Maybe I'm not the powerful person here. Wait a second. This person across the table from me is actually significant and influential. And doing that will allow me to see things through your point of view.
It's a good way for a boss to think about an employee, for example. Selling the employee and working hard and being dutiful and all that.
If more bosses were to do that, the world would be a better place.
Yeah, well, the key to moving others, you say, is to change their minds, though. Sometimes you have to be pretty assertive and aggressive to do that, obviously.
Sometimes you have to change people's minds. But what's really interesting is that sometimes you don't have to change their minds. Sometimes you can
reinforce.
You just give them an off-ramp to act. This is real. This one of my favorite pieces of research in this is a study of a food drive at a college. And so what they did is these researchers had the students identify who are the people least likely to give to a food drive. You know, the most self-interested, non-charitable people you can imagine. Then they said, let's identify the students most likely to donate to a food drive. And then what they did was this. So they had two groups of people. And so some of them sent a generic letter saying, dear student, we're having a food drive. Would you contribute? Others of them, they sent a letter saying, dear Michael or Fred or Maria or Jose, we're having a food drive. This is the date. We would like these particular kinds of food. You can drop them off at this particular place on campus. Here's a map to this particular place on campus. They're basically giving them very detailed instructions and making it as easy as possible. It turned out that the students who were least likely to give to a food drive gave three times as much food as the students who were most likely to donate food but didn't have the clear off-ramp. So in many cases, we don't have to change people's minds. We just have to give them an off-ramp to act.
Okay, Daniel Pink, our guest, To Sell as Human is his new book. And let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. Do you sell in the world you're employed in, or do you feel that selling is vital? And to what extent do you really countenance the idea that you have to have a certain kind of sales, if you say salesmanship, salespersonship. We want to not be sexist in our lexicon here, but feel free to join the program in conversation. Any questions for Daniel Pink, who, as usual, has done a lot of research to back up what he has to say here. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, but feel free again to join the program. Again, toll-free. Our number, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. Ambiverts are better at selling. I mean, this is, again, research. Everybody would think an extrovert would be better at selling.
Everybody would think extroverts are better at selling, including the people who hire salespeople. The research is very clear. Extroverts are more likely to go into sales. Extroverts are more likely to get hired in sales jobs. Extroverts are more likely to get promoted in sales jobs. So there's this belief that the best salespeople are the gregarious, glad-handing, back-slapping extroverted types. The problem with that is when you actually look at the link between extroversion and sales performance, that is, how often the cash register rings, the correlation is essentially zero. And so there's some really interesting new research out of Wharton. Adam Grant, the youngest tenured professor at Wharton, recently completed a study that's going to be published in a couple of months, where he went to a software firm and he gave people in the software firm a kind of assessment that a lot of us have on the job, measuring personality and in particular introversion and extroversion. Located these people on an introversion-extroversion spectrum where one is extremely introverted, seven is extremely extroverted. What he found, and then he followed their sales performance over the next 3 months. What he found is that the extroverts did better than the introverts, a little bit, not as much as you would think.
Not as considerable as, yeah.
Not as much as you would think. They barely eked it out, but neither did nearly as well as the group that you just mentioned, the ambiverts. Now, ambiverts, it's a term that's been around since the 1920s. And it describes people who are not on the extremes. They're not extremely extroverted. They're not extremely
They're kind of hybrids between the two.
They're hybrids. They're the middles. They're on the 1-7 scale. They're not sixes and sevens. They're not ones and twos. They're 3s, 4s, and 5s. And here's the thing. Sixes and sevens, the strong extroverts, are terrible. The data show they're terrible salespeople. Why? They're too forceful. They overwhelm people. And they don't shut up. They talk and talk and talk and talk. And as you said before, listening is essential. Now, what we can conclude from that isn't that, oh, wow, we should hire these strong introverts as salespeople, because they're not very good either. They're less likely to strike up a conversation. They're often not assertive enough. The people who really flourish are the people in the middle, a little bit extroverted, a little bit introverted. They know when to speak up. They know when to shut up. They know when to push. They know when to hold back. And the good news for all of us who feel like, ooh, selling is not something that I do, is that most of us are ambiverts. Most of us are not on the wings there, very strong extroverts or very strong introverts. Most of us are 3s, 4s, and 5s. And even if you're a 2, you can learn how to be a 3. And a 3, a moderately introverted ambivert, is going to do a lot better than a strong extrovert.
Well, then there are these outliers like myself, an extrovert who's really an introvert or something along those lines. But there are actually good ways of good metrics and measurements to quantify extroversion, introversion.
There are a lot of really interesting different methods to give us that. And it actually ends up being, I think what's interesting, a fairly stable personality characteristic. So someone who is more introverted than extroverted as a 5-year-old is likely to be more introverted than extroverted as a 35-year-old. But again, most of us are ambiverts. And so someone like me, I test more to the introverted side than the extroverted side of the spectrum. But over time, so maybe I test as maybe a high 2 or 3. Here's the thing. I can learn how to do things a little bit. I'm never going to be a 6 or a 7 ever in my entire life. I could work on it all the time. I would never be a strong extrovert. But I can learn some things, and I could be a 3.5 or a 4, and that's where you want to be.
Sales increases mean more commissions. In many people's minds, that is absolutely cause and effect. In fact, the idea of incentive of sales commissions means there will be more sales. Not necessarily true.
Not necessarily true. This is heretical to some people. We have this idea that salespeople, these are people in sales. This is not me getting my son to take a shower. This is not me trying to get people to help me out on a project. This is sales. The idea is that salespeople are coin operated. Put a little quarter in the slot in their back. They'll do a little dance. When the time runs out, they'll stop dancing. And there is some not only evidence but emerging practice challenging this. Several companies have eliminated commissions for salespeople and seen sales go up. It seems completely counterintuitive.
Are we naming companies here?
Oh, sure. I'll give you a great company, a very big publicly held company in a brutal industry, Microchip Technology, $6 billion public company. They eliminated commissions for salespeople 10 years ago and are one of the top performing companies in their industry. And the reason that this seems to work sometimes, I don't think there's a universal remedy here, is that salespeople being human beings, being rational responders to certain set of incentives, will often game the commission system for their own advantage. So let's say that I get a commission. I get a bonus if I sell 12 units this month. I get a big bonus if I sell 12 units this month. But once I hit 12, I don't get an additional bonus for anything above there. So let's say I've hit my 12th unit. I've hit my big bonus for the month. Here it is, the middle of the month. I got someone calling me up saying, Dan, I want to buy your widget. I say, hey, listen, call me back February 1. Call me back February 1. I don't want to put this on the books right now. Call me back February 1. And so there's research out of Stanford showing that those kinds of targets actually can impede company performance, company profits. If you talk to managers, talk to anybody who's managing anything of a sales force, they're spending a huge portion of their time litigating these commissions. Who's responsible for what? Who just got ripped off? And so there's some companies that are moving to a hybrid system of higher base salaries, some amount of variable comp, but not keyed entirely to this coin-operated view of salespeople.
Actually, let me get a caller on here. Dick, you have a key to sales success. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm 58, and I've been selling things since I was a teenager. My youngest daughter works for a charter school, my older daughter for Patagonia, my brother in car sales, and every one of us has used one rule to get what we want to get, and that's to walk a mile in the other person's moccasins prior to approaching them. It's, like you say, the middle of the scale on introvert, extrovert, but think about why they would want what you want. You know, my daughter's teaching the toughest district in San Diego in a charter school of kids who have no ambition towards school, and she's got to sell them on the concept, and she's doing it.
Yeah, and teachers have to use sales techniques. I think the concept here about everybody needing to sell to some extent or sell themselves. In fact, how important, and Dick, thank you very much for that call. How important, Daniel, is it to sell yourself on yourself, that is to sell yourself on being confident and being
interesting,
nice guy, likable, all those kinds of things?
Well, I mean, there is – I mean, Robert Cialdini at Arizona State has shown that actually there is something to be said for likability.
Q factor, we used to call it.
Yeah. Likability actually ends up being important, that you're more persuasive if people like you rather than if they don't like you or they actively dislike you. It doesn't seem like rocket science, but it's important to understand. I think that what's interesting about what you're talking about with regard to confidence goes to the concept of buoyancy, which is how do you stay upbeat and alive and ready to do this this enterprise. There is some research. Let's think about what we do before a sales call or before going to ask somebody out on a date or before trying to ask your boss for a raise. The conventional view is that our self-talk should be positive and affirmative, but that turns out not to be what we should do.
Well, I don't necessarily need to sell you, our listeners, on being involved in this program, but let me give you the phone number and invite you to join us with questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post any questions or comments you have there, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or our Facebook page. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking to Daniel Pig. He'll be speaking tonight at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Daniel Pink, examining the science of sales, including a variety of everyday tasks that involve what he calls non-sales selling. He's author and former speechwriter for Al Gore, talking about his new book, To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And we're going to bring you into this conversation. But first, let me go back to something we left before we went to that break. And that was the whole question of self-confidence and how important this is in the whole equation.
Sure. Let's talk about self-talk as an aspect of self-confidence. We talk to ourselves all the time. It's not weird. It's what we do. And
try not to do it out loud in company, though.
Yeah, but we do it to ourselves. There's a whole literature on what people say to each other. Inner talk. Self-talk. So our belief is that when we go into an important encounter, whether it's a sales call, whether you're some other kind of persuasion effort, that what we should do is we should pump ourselves up. We should say, you can do it. Affirmative, positive, confidence bolstering, you can do it. What the research shows out of the University of Illinois is something a little bit different, that instead of saying you can do it, you instead should ask yourself, can you do it? Now, the self-help gurus, you know, they're slapping their foreheads. They're in disbelief now. You're going to let some doubt enter into this? And what the research—
might hurt your self-esteem to do such a thing, right?
What the research shows is that what's called interrogative self-talk, can you do this, rather than you can do it, is more effective. Why? If I say to myself before an encounter, Dan, you can do it, you're awesome, you got this, you're fantastic, I feel pretty good, all right? I like telling myself I'm awesome. I like hearing that I'm awesome. But it doesn't prepare me. Whereas if I say, Dan, can you do this, what do I do? Questions are more active. And so if I'm going in to, say, pitch a new book, can you do this? I say, well, yeah, because I can do this. I've done this before. Remember what happened this time. Remember what happened that time. Can you do this? Yeah. Well, I'm really well prepared. This is an awesome idea, and so I know it inside and out. Can you do this? Yeah. I know I got to mention this one thing to persuade Maria over there. Can you do this? Yeah, and I've got to make sure that I emphasize this point for John over there. And what you do is something much more muscular than that kind of empty-headed affirmation. You ask a question, questions are active, and you begin preparing yourself, equipping yourself with some of the tools, some of the techniques to actually do it. And so so interrogative self-talk, can you do it, is actually more effective.
Yeah, there's a lot in your book about questioning and about the importance of questioning before you go into any situation that involves selling techniques or selling viability. I want to just, before we get our callers involved and our listeners, touch on this because it keeps coming up in different contexts, even recently, maybe just serendipity. I've read about it, heard about this 3-to-1 positivity ratio.
Yeah. You know, I have to say positivity is one of those words that makes me want to roll my eyes a little bit.
Norman Vincent Spiel, we used to say.
And what the research at Barbara Fredrickson at the University of North Carolina has found is that people have higher levels of well-being and are more effective when their positivity ratio, that is their ratio of positive emotions, interest, gratitude, awe, those kinds of things, outnumber their negative emotions, anger, resentment, guilt, by a certain ratio. And she found, working with a guy in Brazil named Marcel Losada, that it's a certain ratio, a ratio of 3-to-1. When our positive emotions outnumber our negative emotions by 3-to-1, we tend to be better off and higher performing. There's a ceiling on this, of course. It ends up being a very high ceiling. It's a ceiling of 11-to-1. When our positive emotions outnumber our negative emotions by 11-to-1, we're in la-la land. I mean, you're living in a state of delusion. But there is evidence of positivity as a form of both well-being and effectiveness. That said, there's something to be said for some people write a little bit about what's called defensive pessimism, where you actually think through ahead of time the horrible things that could go wrong, and then that actually reduces your anxiety and prepares you a little bit for the encounter.
Paul writes on our website, this reminds me of Milton Friedman's erroneous conception of the rational economic man, the so-called homo economicus.
Yeah.
Social psychology, neuroscience, and anthropology have repeatedly revealed that economic motives are shelved when pitted against social imperatives. The assumption that we are naturally oriented to buying and selling is untrue, and this sounds like a step in the direction of continued commodification of everything, which is already devastating for civic values.
Well, I mean, I understand where he's coming from here, but this idea that that selling or making an exchange is somehow kind of this merciless accommodation to a treacherous world, it doesn't ring true to me. It's basically how human beings have advanced, and what we're talking here is what does a good teacher do? A good teacher persuades you to do something a different way. What does a good doctor do? A good doctor helps you heal by persuading you to do things a different way. The greatest sales job that I've done in my entire life, there was not an exchange of money. It was 22 years ago when I asked my wife out on a date, my now wife out on a date. She was nobody's wife at the time, fortunately. And so So I understand where he's coming from. The other thing about rational economic man is that I've written a lot about how much of a fallacy that is. I mean, the last book that I wrote, Drive, basically calls into question our reliance on carrots and sticks as motivators for human beings.
Well, in fact, here's somebody who pretty much supports what you just said. Tony writes, I worked in sales on commission for a year before I went back to school, get my PhD. I occasionally tell my students that teaching is just like sales, but without the incentive system. I'm not particularly extroverted, but I was selling a technology product. Understanding what the customer wants and how our product can help them is far more important than anything else. Someone who is good at sales must be good at listening. Your guest mm-hmm. is absolutely correct. For most people, sales can be learned. So-called natural salespeople are, more often than not, unsuccessful. Mm. Although I have a friend who became a salesman and he studied Malcolm Maltz and he studied, you know, all these salespeople and everything. There is a certain, you know, sort of like being a gymnast in a way. There is a certain talent for sales, it seems to me. Ben writes, is there any research into the role of mirror neurons in this ability to attune oneself to others?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's been a lot written on mirror neurons, and to me the takeaway for this particular realm is on mirroring in general, and here's what I mean by that. There's a lot of really interesting research showing what social psychologists call mimicry, that is matching somebody's mannerisms and even the words that they use. Turns out to be an enormous – it sounds duplicitous, but it's really not.
It sounds simian to me, actually.
Well –
that's what primates do.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. It's not duplicitous. It's actually part of what it is to be a mammal, precisely. So if you go to you know, anywhere in San Francisco and watch people, especially people who like each other, you'll see them mirroring and mimicking their gestures, their posture, and so forth. And so there's a lot of research showing that physical component of matching somebody's gestures, matching somebody's posture, even using the same words and phrases is a way to help understand their perspective a little bit more deeply. It's a great example from the world of restaurants. So let's say that I am at a restaurant and I make a lot of research on restaurants and waiters and tips. Let's say I'm at a restaurant and I say to the waiter, I want a roast beef sandwich with extra horseradish and salad, not fries, on the side. If he says to me, oh, so you want a roast beef sandwich with extra horseradish and salad, not fries, on the side, he's going to get bigger tips. If waiters who actually repeat back what someone has said, rather than say, okay, got it, or sure, no problem, waiters who repeat back exactly what their customers say earn bigger tips.
Well, actually, the next caller, I think, is talking about what he learned working in restaurants. Christopher, is that right?
That's correct. I guess I have more of a comment at this point, less of a question, because I was interested in the research around how this notion of salesmanship applies to personal relationships outside of the business arena. But yeah, my experience is I spent a lot of years in high-end fine dining, but it's been 6, 7, 8 years since I was involved in that field, yet I still find that it informs my interactions with my friends, family, loved ones, and I'm not trying to sell anyone, but nevertheless, the mechanisms that I learned, the behavior patterns, really, I think, helped me have more successful, closer relationships with the people in my life.
Can you give an example, Christopher?
Well, just a whole bit about mirroring, being able to understand what somebody is looking for and perhaps, you know, drawing their attention to the fact you recognize what their needs are. It makes you a great friend that they simply recognize, oh, this person understands me. And that's how you can be effective in sales, is by getting that other person who may be on the other end of the phone or in front of you to know that their needs are understood and you have somebody who actually cares about serving you.
And how much of this, I'm wondering, Daniel Pink, has to do with the whole idea of the quid pro quo? I mean, you give someone thoughtfulness and empathy and presumably it'll come back reciprocally, or even do a favor for someone, which building relationships mm-hmm. is all about mm-hmm. sales mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, there's actually some pretty interesting research on that, actually done by some of it done by a guy, the same guy who did the ambiversion research, a guy named Adam Grant at Penn. And what he's shown is actually people's reciprocity styles affect their overall success. And but what's interesting is that the people who's ultimately flourish the most are people who are actually the most generous, who actually go beyond that kind of pure quid pro quo and take a more generous long-term view of things and actually aren't keeping a tally in their head of, hey,
they're not keeping score.
Yeah. Who Krasny owes me one. And the Christopher's point about, I think one of the great things, I've waited tables before too, and I think that it's a great learning experience. And one of the things that waiters and waitresses do very well is what's called reading a room, reading a table. That is, there's this great capacity to look at a situation, look at a group of people saying, oh, okay, they're not saying this to me, but here's what's going on. A is mad at B, C is not part of the conversation, and the really great salespeople have this great sense of what I call social cartography. They can walk into a setting and in their heads draw a map of who's related to who, who's the decision maker, and so forth. But there's some ways for civilians like us to get better at that.
That's a talent.
It's a talent, but you know what? It's a learnable skill.
Talk about learnable skills. You got a lot in here about pitches, and now I'm not talking about the old elevator pitches. I mean, we got Johnny Cochran and Ronald Reagan, and, Twitter pitches, yeah. And Pixar pitches, and give us a sense of or a sampling of what you're talking about here.
Sure. The research shows some really cool things about effective pitching. Let's go back to your point about questions. We should be pitching more with questions, and Ronald Reagan was a good example of this. In 1980, he's running against Jimmy Carter. The economy's in the tank. And instead of saying your economic situation has deteriorated over the last 48 months, a statement, an affirmation, he says, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
It wasn't even a Carter. It was the American people. Yeah.
Right. It was in an effort.
That's who he's selling to. Yeah.
It's an effort to displace Carter. Now, that question was powerful. And there's research out of Ohio State that tells us why. This is real. I mean, this is really useful. It's a very simple kind of algorithm. Here's the thing. When the facts are on your side, clearly on your side, it's smart to pitch with questions. Why? Same reason we talked about before. Questions are more active. So if I ask a question in your self-talk, even if you're not saying it explicitly, you have to actively respond in some way rather than a statement which can sometimes wash over people. And so when Reagan asked that question, what happened is this. People said, 1976, oh my God, my situation is worse. And so So they began summoning their own reasons, their own intrinsic autonomous reasons for agreeing with him. When people summon their own reasons for agreeing with you, they adhere to it more deeply. This is why Mitt Romney, it didn't work for Mitt Romney. Remember, Mitt Romney wheeled this out for about 6 or 7 days in 2012, sort of recasting this Reagan question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And what happened? It didn't work. Why? Because the facts weren't on his side. People took an active response. Am I better off now than I was 4 years ago, 2012? Oh, man, things are pretty crummy. 2008. My God, I think they were actually a little bit worse. Maybe I am a little bit better off. And so what they did is they summoned their reasons for disagreeing with him. He wheeled that out for 6 days, never mentioned it again. So the principle here is when the facts are on your side, it's smart to pitch with
questions. But Romney was talking to all those people who were out of work. I mean, the unemployment numbers were going up and so forth. That was who he was trying to reach, I think, with that. But the numbers were not the scale.
It was, but what it did is it had people think, are you better off? It's a question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? They compared their state in 2012 wasn't great, but their state in 2008 also wasn't great. So there wasn't a deterioration. In some cases, there was a mild improvement. You see it in the polling data. You see it actually in the economic data. And so what Romney should have learned is, I think what he did eventually, what the research from Ohio State shows is when the facts are on your side, it's smart, clearly on your side. It's smart to pitch with questions. When the facts are not so much on your side, get some new facts. Or
get some new facts. And it's also smart to pitch with doggerel rhyme like Johnny Cochran did. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit, that sort of thing.
Well, I figured you would appreciate this as a student of poetry. Yeah. There's some
doggerel's not my favorite poet.
There's amazing. Well, one man's doggerel is another man's rhyming sonnet. The research, there's interesting research out of Lafayette College that basically says this. It's a really cool piece of research. So what they did is they gave people aphorisms phrased slightly differently. So an aphorism like woes unite foes, and then some of them woes unite enemies. And people found that the rhyming aphorisms, they said, were truer statements about human character. That is, and what happens—
Well, it sticks in the head more, too, doesn't it?
Well, it's not only memory. It increases what cognitive science call processing fluency. And so it's easier to go down, but people tend to—because it increases processing fluency, people consider it even more and actually begin to agree with it. This is why 18 years later, everyone remembers, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
And we'll take more of your calls. Javier, good morning.
Yes, thank you very much for this program. I found it very interesting, first and foremost. My question actually has to deal with a recent conversation I had with a friend. He said that he believes that there's a series of questions and actions that if you follow that sequence, you can basically unlock yes. Do you think that's true?
I'm skeptical of that. I'm skeptical of any kind of universal theorem or keys to the kingdom when it comes to dealing with human beings, because human beings are so complex and so interesting. They're rational sometimes, they're irrational other times. And so I think what's better is really understanding at the unit of one, what's this person about? What are this person's interests? What's missing from this person's life? How can I do something to help this person flourish? But I don't think there is. I wish there were, because I'd be saying it a million times on this program, a set of four questions that would somehow unlock people's desire and convert them to yes.
Let me thank you, Javier, for your call. And by the way, I want to read a couple of emails here. You can email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment if you have questions or comments, or join us by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Andrew writes, if you don't compensate a successful salesperson with an incentive such as a bonus or commission, how do you motivate them? What intrinsic rewards would be more effective? And to that question, how would you sell that to a team?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think what's interesting here is that why would then sales be different from anybody else? Why would not a great a marketing director or an art director or an IT programmer not – why do they do good work in the absence of these kinds of external if-then incentives?
Our sales, the usual answer is because they love their work.
Well, there you go. So my view – just to be clear, I'm not saying that we should eliminate commissions for all salespeople at all times. What I am saying is that we should challenge the orthodoxy, that that's the only way to do it. And so people who love what they do, who care about something deeply – to me, if they're selling a product, have the same kind of internal motivation as someone writing code. I think what's also interesting, you see it in a lot of technology firms, even out here. There's a company I write about, a couple of companies I write about, Palantir Technologies, Atlassian, which has an office out here. These are companies with hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue every year, hundreds of millions of dollars in sales, and they have no salespeople. Why? You ask the executives there, and they give you these Zen-like answers. No one's in sales because everyone's in sales. That everyone who actually deals with a problem, touches a customer, is in some ways in sales. None of those people are individually compensated with commissions, but they care about the product. They want to serve the customer. They want to help out their teammates.
Talking to Daniel Pink, his new book is To Sell Is Human. He'll be appearing at the San Francisco JCC this evening at 7 o'clock. And Ridge says, people don't like to be sold. They prefer to buy. Mm. My best salespeople are knowledgeable and genuinely enthusiastic, but not extroverts. Enthusiasm is critical. Of course, you would agree with that.
Yes.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Dan, join us.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to comment on the matter of how salespeople are trained. I've spent 30 years in the financial services industry, and one of the things I've realized about how sales training works is that it's went along the lines of World War II soldiers. They blow a whistle, all the salespeople jump out of the trench, they take a bullet, and if they do, then they blame themselves. And so the culture of sales training in the old days, at least, that I saw was a lot of the negative self-talk, is that if you're not successful enough, there's something wrong with you, when in fact it was just the way that the whole sales game is played and how people are prepared. And specifically, I learned from a behavioral psychologist to reward myself for behaviors that led to success rather than success. And as a result, I became more successful. So that's all I wanted to share.
I'm glad you did. Thank you, Dan. Yeah, I'm struck by the human in your title, too, To Sell as Human, because there is, again, this sleazy association that many people have with selling telemarketers and, people, Fuller Brushman. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to malign them. Some of those people were really good people, to be sure. But there's a sense that, you have to go out there and beat the pavement and wind up really selling yourself perhaps more than you do the product in some fashion. And the fact of the matter is, there may be a human nature to this that you're suggesting. That is, there's something about our humanity that we want to put forward when we're selling whatever it is we have to vend of ourselves, of our self-image, also of whatever our product might be or who we're working for.
If we care about something, we want to sell. We want to sell it. If we care about other people, we want to help move them. This is true in our personal lives and our romantic lives. And if you go back to that research showing it's not extroverts but ambiverts who do it best, most of us are ambiverts. It suggests that human beings in some ways are wired to do this. And this view of hoodwinkery and sleazebaggery is in some ways a moment in time when sellers always had more information than buyers. But this idea of making an exchange, of trying to do something for someone else, of serving them, of saying, hey, let's you and I trade resources so we're both better off, to me, arguably, is one reason why our species advanced, why we're not simply those apes mirroring each other's gestures. We actually got a little bit beyond that.
But there's a place where you can go too far.
Maybe, absolutely.
Maybe it's intuitive. I remember somebody trying to sell me a timeshare, and she was just pushing and pushing and making all kinds of what at least passed for human connections, but what I thought was really just hotboxing, you know, trying to make me connect in a way that would get me to buy and sign on the dotted line.
And did you buy?
No.
See, there you go. That's my point. My point is that those kinds of pushy...
But she sold a lot of timeshares. That's my point, too. I mean, you know, it didn't sell one to me. I'm not trying to put myself
in
the stratosphere here, but the fact of the matter is that those... You can cross a line, and you have to know where that line is, whatever you're selling.
There's no question. I think that the line is different today than it has been. I think the line is greater transparency, not perfection, greater transparency, greater ethical behavior, much more the high road of service and expertise than, you know, what can I do to put you in a Buick this afternoon?
Heather is our next caller. Hi, Heather. You're on.
Hi. In the 80s, I was a management consultant with a professional services firm, one of the what was then Big Eight accounting firms. And I was a consultant in sales training, and all of the traditional training had been just like that. You know, the guy walks into a bar and says, hey, babe, what's your sign and why you should go out with me? And all of a sudden they changed the training, and I was always the only woman in the room. And all it was about active listening and open-ended questions and this and that. And I was like, this is the way my mom taught me to get a guy to like me. I know totally how to do this. You walk into a bar, pick out the guy you want to ask out. You want him to ask you out. And then how do you get him to ask you out? So all of a sudden I had a leg up. And I'm a realtor now. And of course it's disproportionately women. Most of us, most of the real estate services was men in the 70s and 60s. I'm a third generation realtor, but my dad and grandfather and uncle and cousin weren't taking women into the firm. So, but now we listen to what both people want in a house and get them into it. And it's great.
If you could reduce one of the best pieces of advice for anybody trying to persuade, influence others, or just be a better friend or spouse, it is talk less, listen more.
Heather, thank
you. And I think
you.
Women do that better.
Generally, I would agree. Heather, thank you. Lisa writes, artists traditionally have difficulty selling their work. They need to perfect their story, which can be hard for them. How would you advise them in improving their sales skills?
Well, I think part of it would be to overcome the association they have that selling is somehow seamy. If you look at some of the very best artists, the artists whose names we know, one reason we know their names is because they were so proud of their work, so into what they were talking about, and willing to tell other people about it. Contemporary people like Damien Hirst, no one ever accused Damien Hirst of not being a good salesperson. Andy Warhol, even Picasso himself. Picasso was out there saying, hey, this is pretty good. Take a look at it. I think we have to get – it's a little bit precious, this idea that if you create something wonderful, the world will beat a door to your path. If you create something wonderful, I think that you have an obligation to share it with the world.
Well, Anne asks a very important question. How much do looks matter? And certainly the research shows that looks do matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually didn't write about that, but it's an interesting question. There is some evidence that there's an advantage for that good-looking people – have an advantage.
You do better in singles bars too,
particularly in getting hired.
Yeah, I mean, there's the research I think shows over and over again. Men and women who are better looking and taller, men and so forth. But Andres tweets: Apple doesn't give sales commissions.
Right.
I think that's the case. And just hearing Apple starting to slip with it. No, Jason, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, Michael and David, thank you. This is a profound conversation. I think that impacts every area of life for people.
I want to sell you on the correct name, though. It's Daniel. Daniel.
Oh,
David, yeah.
Daniel, I'm sorry. And so I have been in sales for a long time, and I was actually a bad salesperson. And I found myself randomly immersing myself in personal and professional development programs, everything from leadership and team building to self-actualization, even shifting one's paradigm. And I'm now one of the top sellers in my field. I sell in-home sales residential solar systems. And the one thing I've found is that the people in my industry, the top salespeople, they don't sell. They make a point of not selling. They simply, and this goes back to personal and professional development, is they strive first and foremost simply to connect on a human level, to build that rapport, to build that background of relatedness. And along the way, they take every step to point out where they don't know something or where they might be flawed in some way, and have, shared humanity. And simply, once, if that's not present, then they really don't move forward until it is, and then they simply present an opportunity. And, I'd love to hear your comments about that off the air.
Okay, thank you. Daniel Pink.
Sure. I mean, I think especially for something that what you're talking about is, in-home solar, first of all, someone selling that is actually doing something good for the world. And at some level, you're identifying a need that some people don't realize that they have. And so the more you listen, the more you take the other person's perspective, the more you identify new problems, the better off you'll be. And in some ways, this is the antithesis of the always be closing drive to the conclusion. It's about expertise. It's about perspective taking. It's about solving new problems.
We're almost at the end here, but I was just reminded inadvertently of many years ago, I wanted to do an article on, I came up with the idea of, what about people who have the same birthday and are born, close in time, and they have the same horoscope, and what does that mean? And there was a young woman that I knew who was born, like, literally within minutes of me, and I hadn't talked to her in years. I called up, her mother answered, and I said, it's Michael Krasny, I'm doing, what are you selling, Mike? Right away. I mean, just my voice, by wanting information, and there is that kind of cloud over selling that has to be overcome. There are good tips here about how to do it. Daniel Pink's book, again, is To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
He'll be speaking tonight at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. Our program is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Mark, senior editor Dan Zoll, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.